on the public hearing.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have three public hearings of bills that come to us from our Department of Revenue. So we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 303.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 303 is a Senate Finance and Revenue Committee bill, but it was based on discussions that the Revenue Chairs had with Department of Revenue about some administrative issues. And this one pertains to the time limit on people who file returns and when a 2% surplus kicker can be calculated for that bill after the year has passed. And what it does is it sets a five-year time limit. You can see the wording of it. Basically, the only change in the statute would be on page 3, where it says, if the taxpayer fails to file a return for the tax year described in subsection 6 of this, within 5 calendar years of the original date which the return was due, they would not be eligible for a kicker refund if there was one in that year. So it sets a five-year limit.
Okay. And this is not anywhere near kicker reform. This is a
small kicker reform.
Yes. Okay. Do we have, Deborah, you want to come up and say anything more about this? Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. What we have found in past years is that if we do filing enforcement on a person who hasn't filed a timely return, and it may be 3 or 4 or 5 years after the return was due, that in calculating the tax due on that return, we need to give them credit for the kicker that would have been available to them if they had filed the 2006 return, for example, was the last one. And because it isn't actually, according to our attorneys, considered a refund of the personal income tax, the limitations that apply on refunds don't apply to that kicker refund. In fact, if we had a delinquent return for 2001, I believe was the kicker prior to 2006, they would actually be entitled to calculate a kicker refund and reduce their tax accordingly. So this puts a five-year limit on it. The attempt is to make it long enough that we don't run into unintended consequences from the three-year statute on asking for refunds and the 2 years from tax to pay. That's how we arrived at the 5 years date, but then still put some limit on it so that 10 years later we're not calculating kicker amounts.
Okay, so basically under current law, if a taxpayer gets a refund, they only have 3 years to request it.
Madam Chair, under current law, the general rule is that if a person has withholding on wages and they have 3 years from the due date of the return to request a refund of overpaid withholding.
Correct. So this is basically giving them 2 years more than they would normally get for another type of refund.
Madam Chair, that's because there's another provision that allows for further time. It's the longer of 3 years after the return was due or 2 years after the tax was paid. And I know Senator Telfer may be able to correct me on that, but do I have that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So that's how we arrived at the 5 years, to make sure we didn't have some unintended consequences in that strange situations in there.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deborah, I'm still confused as to why the difference between a refund of withholding taxes or estimated taxes paid in, any taxes paid into the mm-hmm. system by the taxpayer, versus the kicker. I mean, do you have some legal reference that I could use or get that distinguishes between a taxpayer's own money that's paid in, that's overpaid? They can't get that back after 3 years, basically, but they can get money through the kicker. Still, their money, they've overpaid, they're getting it back. I don't see the difference.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I will see if I can locate the information that we had from our attorneys that advises that. And I'm trying to recall, but I think because the pot of money that goes into the kicker surplus to be distributed is not only personal income tax, but every other source in the general fund may have something to do with that. And then also the statutory references that provide for refunds in 314, 415, I think may not pick up refunds that are of kicker amounts that are in 291, Chapter 291.
Thank you. In that case, are we confident that by putting a five-year limit on it, we're still not bumping up into any, given that, those differences, which I can kind of understand, but given that, is a five-year limit legal? Is it going to hold up? I mean, can somebody go back to 2001 and get their kicker back?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, your question could be then whether it meets the constitutional requirements to provide for refunds of surplus amounts. And I would have to look at that again. I don't know that it would be a problem, but we can certainly take another look and make sure that we're within the statutory requirements.
It contradicts itself to me. Meaning, if it says you can get kicker money because it's in a pool of money that's flavored with additional taxes other than withholding and estimated tax payments, taxes that have been paid in by the taxpayer, but why 5 years, not indefinitely? Because it's the same pool of money.
But Senator Telfer, isn't, if someone were over withheld, wouldn't that be the same thing, since that goes, and that's just sitting there in the general fund as well?
Well, but according to Deborah's testimony just now, and she's, you know, going to look it up, but it's because the kicker is more than just withholding taxes. So if I have taxes withheld out of my paycheck, my dollars, after 3 years, I can't go back and get them. The kicker is different than that. We can go back 5 years because it's other money other than just withholding. But my question then is, why cut it off at 5 years? Why not indefinitely?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the indefinite is what we have now, and I think our suggestion was it would make sense to limit it to 5 years. Another point is that the pot of money that went into the kicker has been distributed, presumably, and what we would be crediting them with is money that's received in subsequent biennia.
So basically all the kicker money has already been distributed. So anything they file after that money has been distributed is a hit on the general fund.
If I may?
Please.
Well, wouldn't that same hold for any dollars that are collected in 1 year that are expended in those 2 years? The money's gone within those 2 years of biennium. So I guess I would start by getting legal counsel's input on this, because I'm not real clear on how well it will hold up in court. If it's indefinite and we're cutting it off, I can just see somebody challenging that. I can see somebody challenging the withholding piece, because why should I be able to get a kicker back? I can't get my own money back in withholding, both of which have been expended by the state government within that five-year or even three-year period of time.
Well, actually, that's not true. The kicker money has been distributed to other taxpayers.
Right, but the withholding taxes have also been spent through the general fund.
They've been spent.
They've been spent, too.
So if they've been spent and you only have a finite time to assess the general fund, but the other funds have not been spent. They've been distributed to other taxpayers.
But they have been spent.
No, they've been distributed to other taxpayers.
Well, but they're no longer in the checking account of the state.
Correct, but we are not assessing other taxpayers for the money. We're assessing the general fund. The money has gone to other taxpayers.
I see where you're going.
Yeah.
But if you could get me some substantiation that this is going to hold up.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we will talk with Legislative Council. Thank you.
And we can, but I think that's a very legitimate point to see if there's any legal distinctions on this. Paul, maybe you could arrange to have someone from Legislative Council come down on Monday. We'll carry this over.
Okay.
And actually, we, this is just public hearing, so we'll just carry it over to Monday and get somebody from Legislative Council in.
Thank you.
We have nobody else signed. Any other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I correct to assume that these are delinquent taxpayers?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, those would be delinquent returns. If the return had been filed timely, 2006, for example, we run a calculation on the amount of the kicker and mail the checks to them for those timely filed returns.
Follow up. Do you have the right of offset?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, we do.
So there is presumably the normal penalties for late filing.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, there would be whatever penalties would apply if they owe a tax on that delinquent return. If it's outside the 3-year statute of limitations, they would be denied a refund of the withholding amount. But yes, penalties and interest would apply.
Okay. Thank you. That was my question.
And what he said about the offset, that means that if they had a kicker due and the penalties and fines exceeded the amount of the kicker, then that would wipe out the kicker refund.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. There's also the offset of federal refunds that we can do with kicker checks. So if there's a federal tax refund owing or another state debt outstanding and the refund for the kicker can hit against that and reduce that debt.
No free ride.
No free ride. Senator Telford.
But penalties and interest are only assessed if, in fact, the delinquent filing owes money. If there's refunds, there is no penalty and interest assessed.
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, that's correct.
But the language is fails to file a return, which would suggest to me that they're delinquent.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes. If they have not filed the return within 5 years of, I believe it's the due date, then the kicker calculation would not apply to that return. There would not be a benefit of a kicker for that tax year.
Thank you.
Under this legislation,
yes.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, and we'll get Legislative Council in to answer the legal questions. That's an excellent suggestion. Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to talk on this? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 303 and move Senate Bill 303 to Monday's agenda. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 304.
Paul. It's Christine.
Christine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office, and Senate Bill 304 would transfer some of the attorney's fees in cases where, in the tax court, where landowners prevail and the values are reduced. The court provides that they may order for Department of Revenue to pay some of the attorney's fees and reasonable expenses in these cases. And this measure would actually transfer some of that responsibility for paying attorney's fees to the counties for properties that are locally assessed, and it would retain the responsibility for paying the attorney's fees with Department of Revenue for those properties that are centrally assessed.
Okay. We have two people signed up, John Phillips and Gail Riddell. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you. I just kind of briefly describe some background of this to assist you. The bill really focuses on who pays for the attorney fees and costs. Typically, what you'll have is you'll have either a taxpayer or the county or the department that would appeal, and it would be to the regular division, which is the tax court judge. If the taxpayer prevails, the court is allowed, not required, it's permissive for the court to order the fees and costs under this statute. If the taxpayer appeals, there's a statute that requires that the department is automatically named as a defendant. So if you can imagine a case where it's a county appraised account, the taxpayer and the county do not agree on the value, and the taxpayer appeals to the regular division, automatically the department of the state of Oregon is brought in as a defendant. So in some of these cases, we are not really, we don't have an opinion on the value, or we don't agree with one party or the other, we just don't know. But in any case, we're included. There was a case in one county a while back that we attended the hearings. We moved the court to dismiss us from the case because we were not we didn't have an interest and or didn't agree with the parties, and the judge wouldn't allow us to be dismissed because we had a responsibility under this statute to pay the attorney's fees if the taxpayer prevailed. In that particular case, the taxpayer did prevail, and we paid $30,000 worth of fees and costs. So it's an awkward set of statutes in that we're brought into it sometimes when we don't really have a dog in the fight, so to speak. Generally, we do participate more if there's an issue that affects statewide concern. If it's just a value that's between the company and the county and we don't have an opinion, that's one thing. But if it's a principle that might affect other properties and other counties, then we'll typically become more involved. I think that's kind of what I wanted to say about that. This came really as a result of a bill in the 2001 session. It was Senate Bill 130, and this section of law was added for the attorney's fees and costs. Two other kind of issues with this is that if the department prevails or if the county prevails, there's no provision under this law for attorney's fees and costs to be paid by the taxpayer. So in this case, the door kind of swings one way with this statute. Another issue that if you pass the bill, problem concern for us will move to the counties, where there's nothing really in the statute that gives the tax court criteria as to when attorney fees and costs are awarded. It just simply says that the court may award attorney fees and costs. There is already a statute on the books for all other proceedings, ORS 20.105, which provides for attorney's fees for either party, and you lay out in there your conditions for which the court may award these fees. It actually requires the court, in this case, in ORS 20.105, to award reasonable attorney fees when either party willfully disobeys the court order or no objectively reasonable basis for asserting the claim was made. So that's kind of shorthand for frivolous. So if you have a frivolous case or you disobey the court, there already is existing law for attorney's fees and costs to be awarded. So that will pass. That uncertainty will pass. One of the conditions the judge has used is that if the department litigates a case before the magistrate and we are not happy or with the opinion, we can appeal it to the tax court. But if we relitigate the same case, we can be held for attorney's fees and costs. And that would then pass on to the counties if this bill passes. A little bit of uncertainty. To put a little perspective on it in terms of liability, we did do a search in the last 10 years since this language was added, and we have only found 3 cases where attorney fees and costs have been awarded in property tax cases under this statute. It's possible there are more, but because they happen so infrequently, we don't really have a cost system code we just treat it like a contract cost, or if we're paying for a expert witness fee, it's kind of treated as that. So without searching through hundreds and thousands of transactions, we weren't able to find just these 3, but if our memory serves us, these are the three. One of them was in 2004 for $30,000 that I mentioned earlier. One of them was for $9,300. And the final one has not been ordered yet. We don't know what it is. It was settled last summer, and they're still working on the final orders.
When was the $9,300 one?
That was the Department of Revenue versus Kelly in April of 2010.
And these are all cases where the Department of Revenue, these are all appellate cases?
These are all cases before the regular division of the tax court, which means that the tax court has two divisions, the magistrate, which is more informal, and then the regular division, which all of the magistrate cases, when they're appealed, are appealed de novo or heard anew at the tax court judge's level, and he hears them himself.
So are these cases that started out at a magistrate?
Yes.
And then, so that's basically their appellate structure.
Madam Chair, they're appellate in terms of they are the next appeal, but they're heard de novo, so it's not like a review of the record. There's no record that's transferred on.
Okay. I'm kind of wondering how we got this instead of the Judiciary Committee. It is definitely pertains to revenue, but I used to chair the Judiciary Committee, and these attorney fees issues are all extremely thorny. It's very, very hard to work your way through them. But thank you for the explanation. We'll hear from Gil, and then we'll move to questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gil Riddell, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. My role is just to spot some issues with this bill, and John has covered some already. Not surprised. The issue of no standards to guide the court is one that bothers us, and the door swinging one way instead of both ways, and understand that the respondent represents the taxpayers collectively, because the other taxpayers collectively, because these awards or allowances of attorney fees and costs come out of the unsegregated tax account. Counties are really in no better position, of course, to pay these than the state. I'm glad they're infrequent awards. But just, again, as an issue to let you know, that in the area of property tax administration, counties are simple agents of the state. And they are supervised by the Department of Revenue, and the appraisers must have continuing education. So in terms of, I guess I would not characterize us as a separate entity in this context.
Okay. And in these cases, the three that you found, was the reason that the attorney fees were awarded is that there was some kind of action by the county appraiser, or I guess it would be the appraiser in this case, that was kind of over the line in some way? Or why these three cases and not most cases?
Madam Chair, I know the a little bit more of the details on two of them. The first one is the $30,000 award. That was a county case. The department did not tender a defense. We actually moved the court to remove ourselves from the case and were not allowed to. The county made their case, and the court seriously disagreed with their having a reasonable basis for their arguments. And I don't know any more specifics than that. The second case was a department case, and the taxpayer appealed. This situation where the person was on senior deferral, and we had said that, and Senator Telfer will, ears will perk up on this one, because the test for once you're in the program is a dollar amount of income, federally adjusted gross. And we had said that we thought it was a household federally adjusted gross income, because anyone living in the household, whether it was a brother, sister, husband, wife, whatever it happens to be, they're seniors, they're on the program, they're getting their taxes deferred, and the test was federally adjusted gross income. And we said it was household federally adjusted, and they had said, no, it's the one individual, just the one on the program. So we felt that was a principle worth litigating, because it would affect a number of participants in that program. There's 10,800 participants in that program, and and the income test is $39,500. And if that person also then had other people in the household, theoretically there'd be a lot more resource. And we really truly believe that the law was for household federally adjusted gross. And so we appealed that case and lost. And that issue will be dealt with in another bill this session. So
yes,
a separate matter.
Overdue bill, it would seem.
Yes.
So right now, and the senior, I don't mean to get off the subject here, but I can't resist. So right now in the senior property tax deferral, if you have one senior who just only gets Social Security benefits and they're married to a millionaire, they can still qualify?
Madam Chair, under the ruling of the court in that case, yes.
Senator Telfer.
I'll let you catch your breath on that one. John, you just gave two examples, one in which the department kind of pursued the case and one in which you really wanted to be excused and it was a county thing. As I read the bill, in both those cases, the county would be ending up paying the attorney fees. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, if the taxpayer appealed under this statute and the department lost, the county would then pay, yes.
Right. So am I having a little trouble where it's kind of all or nothing? I mean, if there are court fees, the county is going to pay, even though the department may be pursuing the case.
Right. So in one case that you gave us, it was the county driving the train. In the other case, it was Department of Revenue driving the train. And so right now, it's Department of Revenue pays everything, but under this, it would be the county pays everything. What would probably make sense, if you're going to divide it up, it would be
the engineer.
You know.
And Madam Chair, if I could add, the department doesn't, or the state doesn't directly benefit from a successful appeal like it would in an income tax case. This is all we're asked to appraise cases for counties and local governments, basically. I say counties, but really, the money goes into this account that Gil referred to and is paid to all the local governments, so schools, cities, counties, and special districts. So we appraise the case. That's why we become the defendant if we appraise the case. So we would be responsible for defending the case, but the money and the final resolution would inure to the local governments. So I think the theory behind the local governments, if you will, bearing the cost is because they also they gain from the benefits. If we win, all the money goes, the additional money goes to the local governments.
Do you have a comment on that, Gil?
Well, Madam Chair, and to the state school system, probably typically about 40%. So there is some benefit to the state generally.
I think I'm going to have a conversation with my dear friend Senator Pozanski, who's chair of the Judiciary Committee on this one. Okay, are there other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you. As I understand your reference to other statutes, if it's declared frivolous by the court, then the plaintiff or the appellant would pay the cost. So it does swing both ways. If the court declares the claim to be frivolous?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris.
Oh, so you're changing the burden in here, too, as well as who pays.
I'm sorry. I think the question was regarding ORS Chapter 20.105, which says that the court shall award attorney's fees when the party, if the party is a prevailing party.
So does 20.105 apply to these kinds of cases?
Yes.
If frivolous.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Morris, yes.
So that would protect the county or the state from frivolous claims. And if you're only referencing three, that would suggest that there are not many.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, that's correct. So there is protection both directions.
Yeah.
For frivolous.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? We're going to hang on to this one a little bit. And I seriously, committee, I'm going to talk to the chair of the Judiciary Committee. And we might be thinking of a subsequent here because this is a much bigger issue than this particular bill. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 304 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 305. Do our musical staff changes here.
Okay.
Welcome back, Dr. Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 305 is a leftover from the amnesty program that you initiated in 2009. And if you look on page 2 of the bill and think back on that 2009 act, what that bill did was allow program participants to enter into an installment agreement when they had participated in the amnesty program. There's an estimate of what their liability is, and then they could enter into an installment program. But the statute that passed in 2009 was very explicit about when those payments must be completed, and it was May 31st, 2010, or in which they were to be completed, or May 31st, 2010. So what this has done, or May 31st, 2011, excuse me, what this does is give a six-month extension to those who, for those installment participants, and I think the department has some evidence of some that have had trouble making those payments. And then it also gives, you can see under Section 1, sub little e there, for good cause, the department may extend beyond the November 30th deadline for taxpayers to make payments into the program. So it gives them some discretion even beyond the extended date.
Okay. Deborah?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Paul has explained very well what the situation is. When we met with you about a year ago, we were at that time receiving and processing refunds that came in under the amnesty program. Those were required to be filed toward the end of January 2010. We did receive many more applications for amnesty than we had anticipated, and we were concerned at that time about our ability to get through those and get people set up on installment plans in a timely manner. So we wanted to make sure that they had enough time to meet their installment agreements, and we're concerned about the May 31 date. Since that time, we've made a lot of progress. We're doing just fine on those. We have now, we had $8.8 million total set up on installment plans. We have received about $2.8 million to date, so there's still $6 million left to be paid by that May 31 date. As of now, we have about 1,500 taxpayers making installment plans with us. I would say that we have just slightly more than 600 that have not made any payments on the installment plan, so it could be that even if it were extended to November 30th, those folks may not be making payments either. But we just brought this to you as a policy question for you. Do you want to give them some additional time, 6 months, to make good on those installment plans? The consequence of not paying them off by May 31 is that all of the penalties that were excused and the interest are reinstated, and then we would be doing collection activity on those taxpayers on the original amounts.
And a lot of these people, I presume, are people who have been hit by the economic downturn. That might have been a factor in their failure to file.
Madam Chair, I don't know that, but I can assume that that probably is the case for many of them.
Questions? Thank you. I'm inclined to want to move forward with this because in the general economic environment we're in, you can fully understand why people may not be as able as they are, and the amnesty program has been enormously successful. So do you have any other comments to add?
I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk on this one? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 305, and we can expect to see this back before the committee. Okay. Now, the highlight of our day. That's it for us, right?
Madam Chair, that's it for the bills for public hearing. You have an informational segment. And we're hoping to have the Office of Economic Analysis come and talk to you before the forecast, and they have just made it. They're busily putting together the forecast that they will release to you February 15th, next Tuesday. And I wanted to make the announcement that you are cordially invited by the House Revenue Committee to attend the hearing on Tuesday morning at 8. So they want to make sure that you're invited and you're welcome to attend.
Right. This will not be a joint meeting. We will be the guests of the House Revenue Committee. And the forecast, first of all, I'll open up an informational meeting for the forecast methodology, and I'm sure they're just here to butter us up so that we won't get too mad at them, depending on what we hear on Tuesday. So please, Mr. Patowski and company. Turns out that Josh is a neighbor of mine.
Oh.
Discovered. Came back to the old Hillsdale neighborhood at the same time last night. Welcome.
Okay, good morning.
It's actually afternoon. I can see you.
Flies.
You've been working.
When you work on the forecast, weekends, days, more afternoons.
I hope the forecast is more precise than.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski with the Office of Economic Analysis and Department of Administrative Services. To my left is Josh Lehner, senior economist with the office. To my right is Mark McMullen, senior economist. And behind me is Kaneya Vajja. In our office, and I thought since this was an informational meeting, you might see exactly who puts the sausage together, and this is it. This is the entire office I brought with me. One person is missing. We have a person on job rotation that concentrates on the adult corrections forecast and the Oregon Youth Authority forecast. And so that person's not here. They're at the Criminal Justice Commission, and that may be a permanent move to that position. But we're still involved in all the advisory committees and in sort of certifying what the forecast looks like. So with that, this is an informational meeting. And as Paul said, Tuesday we will be releasing the forecast. And so this is hopefully a sort of a brush-up review of the different forecasts you've seen from us and some of the underlying aspects of what goes into that forecast. Oh, I've got it right here. So we've always shown you this. What we won't do today is talk about the Oregon economic model, but the results of that flow into the revenue models, which are down below. Personal income tax, corporate income tax are two of the largest items, definitely personal, and that's very important. We also have, by the way, our Governor's Council of Economic Advisors advise us on the economic model, and they also are invited to join the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors, a group of CPAs generally that are both for companies and for high-end clients, and they also advise us. It's a good way to get sort of on the street view that a lot of times the aggregate data is not going to show you what's going on, or we have certain questions about law changes that are happening and how possibly are their clients going to be changing behavior based on that. So it's a very useful organization, advisory group that helps us. And you can see that this flows down into legislative and policy changes. Good examples of those are Measure 66 and 67, that we work then with the Legislative Revenue Office on what those sort of impacts might be. And then also non-income tax revenue projections. They generally have been small in the past, but, for example, Betsy is rather large. And so those also need to be folded in as to how that affects the overall forecast.
And lottery, would lottery be in that category too?
Lottery, yes, okay. would also be in that. Okay. And we're going to talk a little bit about today on lottery. Josh will be covering that. Okay. So to give you an idea of what to expect, we do four quarterly forecasts each year. In the odd-numbered years, which we are in right now, instead of the June forecast, there's a mid-May forecast. Generally, we release these at the last week of the previous month. So the example here is the August forecast. The September forecast would be the last week of August. We're speeding this one up a little bit rather than the last week of February. It's going to be February 15th, and that's in line with you coming back into session and to giving you sort of a heads up. And then the mid-May forecast this time will be on Thursday, May 12th will be the release. Now, in inclusion to these four quarterly forecasts, there's also actually a separate forecast called the close of session forecast. And this one generally, and I have to use that word generally because it's generally the mid-May forecast that you'll be getting May 12th, and then any legislative changes that happen to the point after that forecast is released to when you adjourn that could affect revenues are then folded into that forecast. Now, technically, it's the last forecast while you're in session is the one that forms the basis for the close of session. So as an example, if you would decide to adjourn May 1st, then the February 15th forecast, next Tuesday, would be the last forecast that you were in session, and that would then become the basis of the close of session. Not that I'm encouraging you to end early. Now, the close of session forecast is usually then comes out at the same time the September forecast comes out. And I imagine now with a more strict sine die time for you, which would probably be June 30th, that would just fit into that type of time frame where then the close of session forecast, once the data comes in, we know what's happened last biennium, then it would be released probably with the September forecast. So that would be the end of August.
So you could basically have two forecasts issued on the same week that said different things.
Yes, but the September forecast then would be looking at, well, what economic conditions since the May forecast have influenced our outlook? But the close of session forecast, that's the one that sets the basis for your budgeting and basically is a ceiling to where you're not allowed to budget over that. So it's really the May forecast adjusted for any of those last-minute legislative changes that could affect revenues. Okay. And also, the close of session in statute and in the Constitution is the one that sets the base for any kicker calculations.
Of that.
Yes. Okay, so today, what we'll cover general fund revenues. We'll look a little bit about the composition of what makes up those general fund taxes. We'll concentrate a little more on the PIT and corporate methodology, because those are very important, and a little bit of historical performance. How well have these forecasts been doing? Then we'll also talk a little bit on what's happening in the lottery. And once again, this is informational. We're not giving you a peek at what we're going to say on Tuesday, but how do we make the sausage, basically? Some guiding principles. This is a current law general fund forecast that's updated quarterly. It's a subtleness there. Current law is really important because, for example, you're most likely going to be addressing issues soon considering the federal tax codes and the coupling to those. Whatever is the current law based on that coupling, that's what our forecast will reflect. So it won't reflect if the bill possibly may pass or what bills are out there, and then we sort of say, well, I think there's an 80% chance that bill will pass, so let's put it in the forecast. We're tied really to the current law aspect. So there's pluses and minuses of that. Because it is current law, we will still, though, provide in our delivery what might be the changes that could occur because these laws may pass. And that, of course, Paul will also keep you informed of that from his shop. The other aspect of a guiding principle, it's unbiased, most likely forecasts, given the prevailing economic conditions and assumptions. And it's very important, I think, that this stays very, very unbiased forecast. You know, we're housed in the executive branch, I think, just for basically a place to place us in. But in my experience, at least over the time, has been that it has been very much an unbiased forecast. But that doesn't mean that there are political pressures. There are definitely political pressures to either raise a forecast or to lower a forecast based on political philosophies. And so we try to divorce ourselves from that as much as possible. As we said, by the way, the unbiasedness and our process that has happened has been a real plus with the bond rating agencies. They usually point out to Oregon's process as one that they think other states might emulate, in that they feel it is very, very unbiased. We're always continuing to find ways to refine models. I think in our website, we're very transparent about what we do, and we try to get feedback in trying to improve what we do. And for every forecast, because it is a forecast, we'd like to have it be correct all the time, but it is a forecast. And so there are errors around that forecast, and we want to be sure that we keep you informed of what that possible range of errors are that could occur for your budget and planning deliberations. So type of forecasts that we do a lot of statistical modeling. The main ones that we do are the PIT, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, cigarette and tobacco. Criminal fines and court fees, we used to get that from the Judicial Department. Now we've taken that under our wing, and we now are forecasting that for them. And then Secretary of State fees, and then lottery. There's other departments that do their own statistical modeling that we take into our shop. For example, liquor apportionment, insurance, security fees. And part of it is just with the number of people you see here and our ability to cover all these things, we simply take these in, we check to see what they've done, but since they are doing some statistical modeling, we allow them to do the administering of these things, and we just take the forecast in. And then some, it's just easier, because it doesn't seem to blend well for a statistical model, is to just take trends or historical averages. Inheritance, the estate taxes, central service fees, interest earnings, these seem to work a little bit better just on trend. This is the December forecast. I need to emphasize that. This is not what you'll see on Tuesday. We're still working on those numbers. But this just gives you a sense of the relative size of the different categories in the general fund, where you can see that personal income taxes is definitely the main item, making up about 87% of the funds. And next is the corporate income taxes at 7%. And then the others are somewhere about 6 to 7%, depending on what happens over time. And then down below here, we show you the lottery. And as you can see, as one example of what's happened over time, lottery levels now in terms of revenues coming into the state are higher than the corporate income tax. And with that, I want to turn over to Mark McMullen for more digging down into the type of methodology for the tax revenues.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark McMullen for the record. So I understand that this is a dry topic for most folks, but I hope we can be of some use today. Where we start is really the overall strategy that we're trying to follow through on here is to take what we know about economic conditions, jobs, income, population growth, and the like, and try to tie those historically to the revenue streams that the state takes in. And the natural place to start here is with the tax return data. When you fill out your tax returns, you have boxes for your wages, for your investment income, for your business-related income. And these are things that we can pretty competently tied to these measures that we have in our economic models, the profits for the business income, the wages and salary earnings tied to the taxable wages and salaries and the tax returns and the like, stock market performance, housing markets, those things fit with capital gains. And this is where we can, you know, bring to bear our statistical models and try to, you know, see what the feed through from the economy into these taxes are. And so that's where we start. We start, of course, with our consensus economic outlook. This time we just recently had our Governor's Council of Economic Advisors meeting, surprisingly, a large amount of consensus this time. There are, of course, a couple outliers who are a little more optimistic and a couple more pessimistic, but for by and large, most of the advisors are saying this, have the same picture of the outlook right now. Doesn't mean it's right, I guess, but at least they're consistent. At any rate, so then we take this, the economic outlook, and along with the tax law systems or the system of taxation, we try to come up with these models to figure out taxable income and liability from these tax returns. Now, then it becomes a little bit more complicated. Unfortunately, the problem with this tax return data, though there are two, are twofold. One is that it's not very timely. And right now, we just got the final, 2009 liability numbers, and about this time next year, we'll be looking at 2010. So it's clearly backward-looking. And the second real issue with it is it's not what you policymakers or people need to craft the budgets. You know, the budgets are crafted based on the cash that comes in the door at the Department of Revenue, not the liability as reported on tax returns. And so today at the Department of Revenue, they'll be taking in some final payments that were, you know, the liability was incurred maybe 10 years ago. You know, it's a small fraction, but it, nevertheless, the flow of collections come in a different pattern than when the liability is incurred. The wages and salaries, sure, the withholdings come out right away, but for final payments and refunds, they typically are concentrated in the next year. So the second step of our analysis is to take what we believe about the tax liability and the taxable income that we've seen off of returns and try to look at the historical pattern of collections, see what recent collections have done, and try to merge the two. And the final step is to layer over that the impacts of any tax laws as estimated by LRO. So in general, the environment here in terms of Oregon's revenue system relative to other states is one of high risk and decent return. In this graph, I'm just looking at some consolidated census information on state tax revenues, no localities here. The red line being the United States, these are all indexed to being a value of 196. The red line, the United States, and the blue line being Oregon, the dark blue line. And in terms of return and growth, depending on the period you take, Oregon either outperforms the U.S. or slightly underperforms the U.S., but it's roughly the same in the average year in terms of growth. What's different is the movement over the cycle. As you see, you know, during the recoveries, Oregon's strong growth translates to even stronger revenue growth, and the blue line tends to catch up with that of the U.S. average as a whole, and then the opposite occurs during recessions when Oregon's revenues take more steep declines than was seen in other states. I put a couple of neighboring states here, partly to highlight the difference that the revenue systems can make. The light blue line being Washington is one to point out insofar as the state of Washington is sales tax dependent, and in particular during the recession at the beginning of the decade, 2001-2002, they didn't suffer the same sort of revenue correction that income tax states did. At that time, as you recall, folks were spending a lot of money using tapping home equity at a very fast pace to fuel consumption, and also consumption was getting boosted up by retailers, particularly the automakers, who were offering 0% financing and very aggressive discounting as the big three domestic firms were trying to desperately hold on to market share. But that little anecdote kind of bears out in the broader data. This is another way to try to, this graph I'm trying to show exactly how volatile the Oregon state revenue system is. And the way this is organized is as you go north to south up the y-axis, that's how much the revenue growth swings around from year to year. So higher means more volatile or bigger swings in the tax revenues. As you move left to right is income growth, how much that swings from year to year, the underlying personal income gains in the economy. Now, we would expect, of course, oh, yes, the Senator Hospice. Yes.
Thank you. The slide before that, I was just curious why it seems like right there in where we are now, 2011, everybody's ticking up except for the green. Is that Idaho at the bottom there? Why is that?
Absolutely, yes. Idaho is lagging behind the revenue recovery as it is, but a lot of that can be traced to the underlying economic growth. Its regional economy is lagging behind as well. Very similar to Oregon, Idaho and some of the other Pacific Northwest states had kind of delayed housing cycle, and so they're still a little bit late to recover, but unlike Oregon, they haven't seemed to see as much of an improvement in consumer spending or these other related industries in recent months.
Senator
Thank
Morse
you.
Has a question.
Thank you. And this is just an academic interest question. Why did Washington not suffer the fate of Oregon in the 2002 recession? They were flatlined.
Yes, and again, most of that has to do with the fact. Excuse me, Vice Chair Morse. Most of that has to do with the composition of the revenue stream. The fact that it was so heavily dependent on the sales taxes, and that recession was a special one. Insofar as it was characterized by, you know, strong consumer spending, while the business investment, crashed. In this most recent recession, the opposite was true. With the credit crunch and the housing crash, consumer spending, particularly on the big ticket durable goods that sales tax bases are depend so heavily on, was hit disproportionately hard. So this was the wake up call for the sales tax state was this cycle. It certainly wasn't the last one when they kind of got a free pass.
And then the follow-up, what I would judge to be your scattergram is Oregon has the second highest volatility of all states.
Yes, yes. Next to Michigan, this is the raw volatility. And once again, as you see with the trend line, you would expect the more volatile the underlying economic conditions, job growth and income gains are, the more volatile your revenue streams would be. But conditional on that, it's certainly the case, or it tends to be the case, that these income tax states have suffered from larger swings in revenue in the past than do sales tax states. And in particular, Oregon's is quite volatile even relative to the typical income tax state. And some of that has to do with the structure and the progressivity of the tax rates. As folks lose income or lose jobs during recessions and gain income and gain jobs during recoveries, they move up and down brackets as well as, earning and losing income. And so these swings are magnified. Plus, Oregon has a high dependence on the handful of 2 to 3% of the wealthiest or highest wage earners in the state. Also exacerbates the issues with some of the behavioral responses in some of these income streams, like the capital gains and the business income, where the taxpayers have some latitude over when they cash in their income for tax purposes. Yes, Senator Haas.
Thank you. Michigan's problem, you might have mentioned it, but I missed it. What makes them so volatile as a sales tax state?
Yeah, Michigan's a little bit of an outlier. A lot of that has to do with, I believe, their property tax system. Michigan's property tax system is similar to Oregon, has strong caps on how much the assessed values can increase over time. However, unlike Oregon, when you have transactions, then that tax gets reset based on the current market value. And well, in the last, particularly the last 5 or 6 years, you've seen all this, a ton of volume of transactions, big price swings, and resulting big issues in Michigan's revenue. But again, this isn't a one-to-one correspondence, but it was just, and North Carolina is another outlier for which I don't have as clean of an explanation. But in general, this is the trend, that the income tax states are tend to be volatile. Sales tax states a little bit more stable, and then the resource ones, the orange ones, are all over the board. Those are severance taxes, are the taxes on natural resources and resource industries.
Good questions? Okay. Good.
So looking at the most recent fiscal year, despite this volatility, my predecessor in the office did quite a good job in terms of, you know, relative to other states. Here we're comparing it vis-a-vis the income tax states with the sales tax states below. And these are the apples-to-apples analysis, the survey that the National Association of State Budget Officers puts out twice a year. Now, this is a little bit misleading. Oregon's problem in terms of our forecast and the revision downward in our expected revenue growth, a lot of that happened in 2009, which unfortunately I couldn't get the same apples to apples chart for because of the 2-year budget cycle in Oregon. In the 2009 estimate, the way the National Association words their survey is, what was your original budget estimate? Well, unlike other states, Oregon did their original budget estimate before the recession, 2 years prior to 2009, when the real downward revision happened, and other states obviously did it, the single-year budget cycle states had a more current forecast, one that incorporated the recession. So once again, personal income tax, this is the big daddy. This is the one that 87%, as you saw, of the overall total. Most of that, two-thirds, are going to be wages and salaries, with the rest split equally between capital gains, business-related income, and then retirement income, sources of income. The point here is that, the size of wages and salaries make our forecast errors there pretty important, but in terms of the difficulty of forecasting and where our highest percentage errors happen, it's in these other smaller categories. These categories typically that incorporate these behavioral responses of the taxpayers, the shifting over time of their tax liability. Wages and salaries is better behaved, but then again, given its size, it is going to account for a decent share of our overall errors, but given these historical sizes, a 10% forecast error in capital gains is equivalent to a 1 percentage point forecast error in wages and salaries. So the fact that we can do well on wages and salaries doesn't, of course, save us too much from our errors because of its sheer bulk. The next chart's meant to kind of. Oh, sorry.
Senator Morris has a question.
I'm sorry. Chair Burdick, Senator Morris.
Do you follow with the Department of Revenue the filings for high-income earners so that as close to real-time as you can get, you know what's happening to that group of filers?
Absolutely, yes, Senator Morris. We have that's obviously a big area of interest. Now, unfortunately, once again, the most timely data we have, the collections data, we don't have as good of a very good idea of where that comes from. The collections, again, they're coming withholdings or finals and estimates. They're not really tied necessarily to these particular, we can't really tie them back to the taxpayers in all cases. So while they're doing a great job matching this stuff, and I'll show you some of the, at least for the capital gains a little later, I'll show you a slide about how we've been tracking these 250,000 and above types. But unfortunately, it's not very timely. Again, we just got 2009, so we know what happened in 2009 pretty well in terms of these folks. But, the main issue in terms of Measure 66 probably didn't kick in until 2010, and unfortunately, we're just starting to get some information on that now.
As a follow-up, is it possible to track the quarterly filings in, almost close to real time in terms of not so much, tabulating the total dollar returns, but just in the number alone, so that if you're dropping, you would know in those quarter, if people have left the state, they're not going to be filing quarterly returns, would they, Senator Telfer?
I'm sorry?
If people have left the state, would they still?
They might if they have source income from
Oregon. If they have source income, but if they leave the state, they would be dropping off.
If they take
unless they have a rental income, you know, income that's source is still Oregon. They may still have some of that.
Okay. So not a very good accurate indicator probably then.
Well, Senator North, the estimated payments are very important to watch, and particularly now that we think we're in a turning point. Unfortunately, most of the time they trail. The final payments and the year-end payments turn the corner before the estimated payments do. And part of the argument behind this is you have the safe harbor provisions that, in terms of estimated payments, you're only on the hook for paying what you did last year or what you did. And I think a lot of times that's what exactly what taxpayers do. So it tends to be a little bit of a backward-looking measure. But that said, it's been strong in January, so I'm holding out hope that that means something.
The quarterlies have been...
The quarterlies, yes.
Yes, we all hope.
Once again, withholding in terms of the wages, this is the one that we do the best job forecasting. It's the best behave, in so to speak. Again, these get pulled out of your paycheck as soon as you earn it, the wages and salaries. So not only are our measures of economic earnings closely matched with those on the tax returns, but it's also closely matched with the contemporaneous stuff that's flowing in, the withholdings that are flowing into the DOR. So typically, our mistakes here in the past, you know, have to do with timing the turns in the business cycle and not so much the translation of economic growth into revenue growth. The second biggest component of income here would be your retirement types. There are three kinds of retirement income here, all of which we expect to grow faster than the typical income stream, which is the black line here, having to do with, again, the aging of the baby boom population cohort. Across types, they behave a little bit differently. Social Security collections are relatively stable. They move along with the population fairly well. The IRAs are a little bit more volatile. These retirement accounts depend on, of course, equity prices. How are the stock market and how are these investments doing, which are difficult to predict and move around from time to time. And they also, again, this behavioral effect. They can cash in their retirement accounts when folks want to. And the pensions are a mix between the two. Pensions used to behave a lot more like Social Security when they were all fixed benefit plans. Now that we're moving to more defined contribution plans away from fixed benefits, starting to behave more like the traditional IRAs. So that's going to be reflected more and more as we go forward in time, as this, you know, the share of these traditional pension plans gets smaller and smaller.
Why wouldn't Social Security be a straighter line? Why is there any volatility?
Well, the business cycle does impact. Well, there are two things that impact the Social Security flows. One is, of course, federal tax law. They change when who's eligible and how much they're eligible for. So that's going, you know, when you see that, you're going to see breaks in growth. You know, this is a growth graph, so it can move around a lot. And the business cycle matters too. It's not surprising that, you know, people start cashing in sometimes for their retirement based on their work opportunities, and they decide whether or not, you know, how much Social Security to take is a complicated decision based on your outside opportunities and your work opportunities, and those change over the business cycle.
I guess I don't understand what the computation here is, because we don't tax Social Security benefits. So what are we talking about here?
Well, there is some taxable Social Security, Chair Burdick.
Work, if you have other income, correct?
That's right. There, over a certain level, it's what is it?
Well,
up to $4,800.
Well, it varies. I don't memorize it, but some of it's taxable at the federal level.
That's right. And in 1996, I believe it was, Oregon made it so that some of it's taxable in Oregon as well. It's up, I believe it's up to a certain cap.
But it's based on other income. Correct. The volatility of all that other income is going to affect how much Social Security is taxed, which pushes it to be volatile.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks.
So now we're moving on. The next one is capital gains, and this, of course, is our tricky one. And this is the chart that I teased earlier, mentioned earlier, about trying to track the upper income and wealthy taxpayers. Capital gains, of course, as you see here, of course, the lion's share of it is really driven by these upper income folks. And these are, you know, of course, also the folks that are subject to Measure 66 tax rates. Here I've broken out the folks that file capital gains on their tax returns into three types. Now, unfortunately, we don't get the full breakdown of our Schedule D worksheets and know how much is housing and how much is stocks and whatnot. But we do know, how the AGI of these folks, you know, what the size of the AGI is, and to a certain extent, some information on short-term versus long-term gains and the like. So as you see here, you know, obviously, every group, you know, lost quite a bit of you know, taxable realizations of capital gains during the credit crisis.
Senator Morris has a question.
Those are dollars, not numbers of filers.
Yes, these are $1 million. And for number of filers show a little bit different picture. This one, as you see, really across all groups, the decline was similar in terms of percentage terms. In terms of number of filers, there was a bigger drop among these very wealthy types. Now, some of that has to do with them moving down, not necessarily moving, but moving down the income distribution and, you know, moving into other below the 250K threshold. And the other thing has to do with the fact that lower income capital gains payers get more benefit out of the losses, or get their losses show up as a bigger part on the return. So in terms of that offsets the number of filers somewhat, so that here in this picture we see that really the declines in terms of the amount of taxable income have been similar across income groups. But once again, of course, the lion's share is held by these wealthy folks. Here we have both the folks that based on capital gains alone went over the 250,000 threshold, another group where their capital gains and other income combined put them over the threshold, and then a third group of everyone else who had capital gains on their returns. Now, the swing down looks a lot like it did in the last recession, the tech bust, and the question is whether or not the recovery will look like it did then. The real solid days for revenue growth, in the middle of the decade. And right now, at least this is the December forecast, and, you know, our thinking is that, and the thinking, and this is backed up quite a bit by the revenue advisors, the idea is that things are a little bit tougher this time in terms of this investment income. What you see here, the character of this forecast, now this one in December, you see has a little bit of a bump up in 2010 and then a little payback in 2011. That was mostly the result of the expectation that the federal tax rates were going to go up for wealthy individuals, which did not occur. The Bush-era tax cuts were extended, and so that this will be smoother. Probably you can expect on Tuesday, but nevertheless, the character is here is that it's going to take another year or so before we really get into the boom that we saw last time, and the reason that the hangover is a little bit more pronounced this time, one is that it's argued that these losses, we don't have good measures of them, but that these losses out there to be carried forward are larger this time around, that there's a bigger stock of them, and part of that has to do with, you know, what happened in the run-up. Here, investors only had a handful of years to build back up their portfolios, whereas heading into the last downturn, you know, a lot of the losses were taken on, you know, there were longer holding periods for stocks, and so the losses relative to when you bought them were smaller, even though the decline in the stock market looks similar, as you can see here. The other issue is housing. Now, housing, you know, some housing transactions, those, you know, investor participation, the flippers, and the luxury homes that have made a whole lot of capital gains, these are subject to taxes. And it's our belief that these were in part behind the big boom we saw coming out of the last recession and in the middle of the decade, and are going to further hold down gains going forward. So because of the asset price appreciation, the equities and the stocks, those are the big drivers of capital gains, and we can expect at some point to see some pretty darn good growth like we did in, you know, similar to what we saw in the last couple of expansions. The concern is when that happens.
But not in housing anytime soon. Right?
No, not in housing. Not in housing. And that's why we have this little bit delay of another year before we get into the same kind of ramp up that we saw in the last recovery. And a lot of it has to do with the housing. So once we get all our ducks in a row in terms of this liability and the taxable income types that I just talked about, well, then we have to spread it out to collections. And this graph just kind of gives an idea of the timing, not to make too much of it, but withholdings and estimated payments tend to come in the same year that they're earned, you know, in the market, that, you know, can ride along lines with the underlying economic activity. Withholdings, you know, over 90%. Estimated payments, 3/4, with the last quarter splashing into January of the next year. And then with final final payments and refunds, the bulk of the payments are collected the year after the tax liability is incurred. The folks paying as they fill out their April year-end returns now, that's based on the 2010 income and the 2010 activity. It's another way of looking at it. We just see here, looking at the overall percentage, the same sort of graph put a little differently, looking at the overall percentage of your revenues that we get. And you do get most of it in the first year, largely because in the next year, these refunds and final payments offset each other. You know, the refunds are a negative, you know, in terms of state revenue or available resources, whereas the final payments are a positive, and these offset each other. But what don't offset are our forecast errors with them. When we tend to miss the refunds one way, we're going to miss the finals in the same way in terms of exacerbating the hole. And so while we have most of, you know, the net income is already in by the end of the year, there's still a lot of uncertainty floating around there. So looking at the other bits, again, lottery is out of here, and lottery is a little bit bigger than corporate. But it breaks down. These are all the other little pieces, but again, none of them are anywhere close to the size of personal income taxes. The corporate outlook, we tend to try to tie to profits, there's corporate profits, trying to adjust for the type of corporations that pay taxes here in Oregon. As you see, we're, you know, a very record period of profitability in recent years. This is expected to cool off. Our macro advisor and the economic outlook for profits has been revised down quite a bit since this forecast was made. One other thing to note with corporate taxes is, as big of a problem as the lag tax return data is on the personal side, it's even worse with the corporate filing seasons. They have different filing years, and as you see here, our hard data, our last bit of hard data is in 2007. So with that, I'm going to pass over to Josh, who will discuss a little bit of our lottery forecast before tying up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Lehner. I'm in the Office of Economic Analysis. And real briefly, as Mark alluded to, I will just talk about the lottery forecast. There's two, we break it down into two different types. There's the video lottery, which is what you think of when you go into your drinking and eating establishments. There's the video lottery terminals you see either in their own separate room or just out in the main eating area. And then the traditional, which are what you think of your scratch-its, your Powerball, your Keno, the Win for Life, things like that. Next slide, please. And historically, video has accounted for about 85% of all lottery sales. It's weekly net sales, so you take the amount of dollars that are plugged into the video machines and then subtract out the amount that is cashed out. So say someone puts in $20, they play up and, you know, their balance goes up and down, and maybe they cash out at 10. Well, that net sales is that $10 there, the difference between they put in and what they cashed out. And that's what we're forecasting. That's the net sales to the state. The long-run growth in this game, the video lottery, is closely tied to overall consumer consumption. It's followed retail sales. It's followed personal consumption pretty closely historically, except for the ramp up in line games that went in 2005. We saw some strong growth in video lottery sales when we put in the line games. And line games are essentially, for most people, the same thing as video slot machines. It's not just your video poker, which you see in other states. Oregon's unique in that we have line games, which are very, very similar to what you think of as slot machines at casinos. And so we've seen strong growth in video lottery when those were implemented in 2005. And then overall, there's some strong seasonal swings to video lottery. Some of it's due to the weather, some of it's just due to, I think some of it's also due to people's social behaviors. During the winter and the colder months, they spend more time indoors, out at their eating and drinking establishments, playing. As the weather turns nicer during the summer months, you see a drop in overall video lottery sales. And then also, within the month, there's seasonal variation. It's closely tied to the your standard pay period. The beginning or the ending of the month is stronger. It's also, you could think of some Social Security checks come in around some of these times as well, and it's also stronger during the middle of the month, maybe the 15th of the month, when you also see a standard payday. And the intervening weeks between those time periods are weaker than you see during the standard payday. So there's a lot of seasonal variation across the year and also within the month. And I believe the next slide talks about some of the traditional games. Again, the traditional games are the Scratches, the Megabucks, the Powerball, and the Keno. And these are forecasted more along seasonal trends and seasonal patterns and historical trends. We include weekly variables such as some weather patterns, the jackpot level for Megabucks and Powerball. Those level of sales there, there's a very strong base that you see every single week. But then when you get the jackpots, that's when you get exponential growth in the sales. So we have some variables in there to control for that. In Mega Millions is a new game, relatively new game to the state of Oregon. It came in April of last year, so it's less than a year old. But it's essentially the same thing as Powerball. So we just combine the two level of sales and forecast them together until we get a better idea of what a player preference is. And so far it seems to be it's jackpot-driven. We saw the Mega Millions had the run-up in the jackpot 3 weeks ago, a month ago, and so we saw a high level number of sales in Mega Millions, whereas the Powerball sales tended to fall off. So we can see the consumer behavior is driven by whichever has the highest jackpot. And overall, we have the video sales plus traditional sales plus any administrative savings that the lottery can put together. It's basically sales above expectations, or if they put off a capital construction project, there's savings associated with delaying any sort of either new gaming system or building a new building. Sometimes they'll funnel those resources back into the general fund. And overall, that equals your total resources due to lottery sales. And a lot of these actually are already spoken for if you think of in terms of the allocations of these resources. The Natural Parks and Resources is 15% of all total lottery resources. That was enshrined in the Constitution last vote measures, and then also the Education Stability Fund gets 18% of all available resources. And then the other ones have varying amounts. Some of them are set by defined formula. Some of them, such as the debt service, is defined by some of the Treasury or the finance individuals. They tell us how much is allocated for the biennium. And then on the last slide should be the video sales. You can see the distinct seasonal pattern we have within the video sales. Again, in 2005, you have the strong ramp-up in video lottery sales due to the introduction of line games. And then when it came to the decline we saw a couple years ago, you had the double whammy of the financial crisis and recession, and then also the smoking ban that went into effect July 1st, 2009. Both of those had strong negative impacts on levels of video lottery sales. Just to give some ballpark estimates, you had during the recession you had GDP go down by 4%, you had Oregon employment go down by 8%, but you had video lottery sales go down by 25%. So the magnitude there is much stronger than you see in some of your other economic variables that are out there. That 25% decline is similar to what we've seen elsewhere. We took a look at Nevada and Las Vegas slot machine sales, and both of those within Las Vegas, and then if you take the rest of Nevada as a whole without Las Vegas, they both declined by about 25% during the recession as well. So we're seeing similar types of declines in other gaming destinations. And that should be the end of the brief overview of lottery.
Okay. The last slide here is just a comparison. It's the forecast errors, which would be over a two-year period. So it's that close of session forecast that we described earlier, and then what happened over the entire biennium. And as you can see from this, and this really does follow sort of business cycles. The positive ones, where the blue column is above the zero line, that's when actuals were above our forecast. And then when they're below, that's when our forecast was above the actuals. And they kind of match up with recession periods here. And also, it kind of matches with how the economic cycle goes. We generally find that when recessions hit, they tend to hit very, very quickly and very deep. But they also tend to be more short-lived than expansion periods. Expansion periods also tend to take more time to unravel. So here we show you the average error, which is the light blue line, and that's about 0.9%. So over a longer period of time, even though you can see that there are more underestimates than there are overestimates, on average it's fairly close to the zero line, where it's not forecasting too high or forecasting too low. And that's some aspect, we like to think, of sort of an unbiasedness towards the forecast. The red lines are one standard deviation. You're roughly about 67% of the time, that's where your errors are falling within one standard deviation. And so you can see the ranges here around that blue line up to about 10% in the when we've underestimated. Actuals were stronger than we thought. And then down to about the 8.5% when our errors are such that we've overestimated. We were too strong in what was occurring. So, and also we want to inform you that on our blog we have recent economic facts and so on that we comment on. But we're also thinking that what we're going to do in a more formal way for you is give you mid-month updates. Rather than be somewhat silent from February 15th through May 12th, when the Employment Department comes out with their new employment estimate, that seems like a good time for us to also come out, say what we're looking at, what we're seeing, and kind of just a monthly update, maybe a one-page or something on our blog, and have you, you know, give you links to so that you can see what's going on in a more timely way.
You could actually start that now. You know, it's Friday afternoon and no one's around, so no one would know.
Just us.
Just us. We'd we're just hanging on your every word.
So if that's our presentation, have questions?
Senator Morris.
Well, thank you. That's very good information. Much appreciated. Would you expect the volatility, or not volatility, I guess it is actually, but the deviation to continue into the future? Is there anything that would suggest that you can achieve nirvana in forecasting, that you're going to be within the 2% with a high degree of frequency?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I think since, for example, the kicker was first instituted, I think there was only one forecast ever in that period that was within the 2%.
And that was our very own Dr. Werner who did that forecast, I'd like the record to show.
We're asking you to do the impossible.
Yes. You mean Lucky Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah. People call it. Senator Morris, unless there are better crystal balls and statistical methods that will be developed, in the near future, given the Measure 66 and 67, it's probably going to add more to the volatility of what we see tax revenues doing, and thus it's going to make it a little tougher for the forecasting.
Well, I did have a very specific reason for asking that, because hopefully we will advance out of this building a referral to the voters that will have some impact
on the personal and the corporate kicker being dedicated into constitutionally protected stability funds. And were you to somehow find a way to stay within that 2%, we'd have to go back to the drawing board and figure out a different way to save for the future than downturns. But it looks like that that probably would be a model that we could expect to put funds into if we reform the kicker, to put funds into to stability funds.
Yeah, as, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, you know, I would like to think that, you know, we're always constantly improving and getting closer to what happens. But there are forces out there that also make it a little more difficult to do so.
If we, along those lines, if we were to move, now that we have annual sessions, if we were to take the next step and move to annual budgeting and annual close of session forecasts, how much do you think that would improve the accuracy of the forecast?
Madam Chair, I don't see it as really improving much at all. Now, what it does, it changes. If then you have, in a sense, a close of session forecast each year, then that helps in terms of balancing to that close of session forecast. But the aspect that we give you quarterly updates are sort of that aspect of, you know, if we've gone through the first fiscal year and we see that there needed to be a change, hopefully our forecast is starting to reflect that, yes, maybe there needs to be some budgetary changes for this last fiscal year. So I don't think it really does change the forecasting capability.
That's interesting. I would expect it would improve it.
Well, it's always easier to forecast out 1 year ahead rather than 2 years ahead. And this is why I think we do the quarterly forecast, to try to make updates as we see new information come in and conditions change.
Well, I was mainly thinking of the kicker, because if you have,
then,
you know, you have more of a precise correction.
Madam Chair, I would agree with you there. Because there, if the kicker was then, the close of session forecast was each year, and the kicker was based on that, then yes, I think there would be a better forecasting capability of being within the 2% relative to having to do it over 2 years.
Yeah, that was my question. Do you have any kind of sense of magnitude of how that would work? Well, let me ask another question. If we were to reduce some of the volatility, for example, the capital gains rate, if we were to reduce the capital gains rate maybe over time, what impact would that have on the volatility and the forecast accuracy?
Well, Madam Chair, that would decline the variability, because definitely the capital gains pushes around, even though, you know, you've seen here it was about the 7 about 9% at times.
Oh, yeah.
The capital gains
7%
over 7%. The average, that changes, of course, a lot.
Yes. Yes, then that would. For example, now that it's been beaten down, it could grow quite a bit, and it doesn't have much of the impact. It's when it gets up to those higher levels, then as it changes, it can have a much stronger impact. But yes, that's true, because it is probably one of the more volatile items that pushes around the revenues.
Senator Tupper.
Thank you. Tom, is there a way to get me, or maybe you know, the difference in the forecast between the March forecast and the May forecast, over, you know, a period of time, 5 years, how different are those two forecasts? Meaning, we hang around here waiting for the May forecast, when, in fact, we could get out of here earlier if we're looking at the February or the March forecast, May-March.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, and I'm going to ask Mark and Josh to jump in on this, too. The tough part is that it's that April, what they call April surprise in the business, that pushes things around quite a bit. So this May forecast has the possibility of kind of moving more relative to the March forecast. And it's just the nature of, because of the final payments and refunds flowing in at that time.
Follow up. Thus, I wanted to know if you had a sense as to what the difference was, the variation between the March and the May, number one. And number two, I know as a practitioner that more and more and more tax returns are being filed on an extension. Now, granted, the payment needs to be made in April, but again, you know, what's the sense of difference between the February or the March and the May forecast over a period of time? How different are they really?
I know we have charts of that. Do you remember?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, you know, offhand, I can't tell you one of that's basically this one quarter to the next. What is the deviation in the forecast? But I mean, that's something we do have spreadsheets tracking all this information that we can go back to the office and maybe on Tuesday we could present that to you.
Yeah, that would be good. Thank you. Well, this has been very helpful. We're a little disappointed we can't kind of get a sneak preview, which is the real reason we invited you in.
Yeah, we thought. Well, I'm out of here.
It's just us in the building.
Just us. No, but the cameras are on.
Well, Madam Chair, that's why we're running back to the office, because we don't know exactly the numbers yet.
Yes, I understand that, and I was very aware of that as you were sitting in the back of the office, back of the room while we were talking about other things. I thought, we're keeping these people away from their forecasting. So thank you for taking the time, especially when you were really pressed for time. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other business of the committee? If not, we are adjourned.